This is Phil Farron.
And I am driving around. I need to adjust this a little bit. I've got to go pick up the little guy here in just a few minutes. But that gives me enough time to drive around and record the podcast. It's been an exciting week. It's just this whole thing is just going to be fascinating. It's just going to be fascinating. So, you know, we're puttering along. All the guys on the IT staff of my major client are being subsumed by another company called Glue, G-L-O-O. So they're dealing with all those potentials and trying to figure out if it's a great opportunity or exactly what's going to happen. And, you know, there are plenty of situations where seems like things could be done a little better. But, we'll see. I still haven't heard anything from them. But they've got so much to do that I'll just keeping track of my time. And if we ever get to the point where I get to the end of the month and I send off my invoices and no one wants to deal with them, well, then that's okay. We'll just go find something else to do. But I would imagine, you know, they'll get in touch with me at some point. I've already talked to the big boss, and he's already talked to them about me, and they have all agreed what needed to be done. So, you know, we'll see. We'll see. It's a massive undertaking, and this week, now that we know it's coming, as we move through our work, we sometimes just look at each other and go, how's this going to work out? Woo! Lots of stuff to do. It's very interesting. I mean, the other thing that's interesting about all of that is that Claude Opus 4.6, I think it's Opus 4.6, was released just a few days ago. Maybe it's been a week. Hasn't been any more than 2 weeks, I don't think. And apparently it has done some just really amazing stuff. Two things about that. If I've got my information correctly, at the same time that Anthropic released that, they also released a little extra file that you could read into. You could just tell Anthropic, here's a file, read this in. And like after it did that, it became like a really good reviewer of legal documents. Now, I don't have any information on how good a reviewer it is or how well it does, but supposedly it just became as good as many of those who are employed to review legal documents. Just like that. Bam. And Anthropic supposedly made some claims how that, you know, there was no reason to have software as a service anymore, also known as SaaS, software as a service, because Anthropic could just build whatever you wanted it to build, and it would use, you know, best practices and et cetera, et cetera. Now, we have not seen that, but the problem is whatever you're playing with now, 2 or 3 days goes by and it's all different. So, you know, maybe that's true now. I do know that a bunch of the software companies that do software as a service just got hammered since then. I was watching one reviewer who added up all the drops in stock prices for corporations like Salesforce, and it said the loss in equity amounted to something like $1 trillion. Just boom. And when he was making the video, I think he said that Salesforce stock was down something like 40 to 50%. I mean, that'll slow you down as a business. You know, so I was talking to a buddy this week and I was saying, you know, if they're actually this close to having that much capability in a month, in 2 months, in 4 months, are we going to be to the point where you can just bring in one of these boxes and set it up and probably make a copy of all your data as opposed to turning it loose on your data and just having it go through all your data and make decisions how to get stuff normalized and present you with options and it builds you whole data entry suites for everything? I mean, is that where we are? I don't think we're quite there. Because it seems like you get the stories of AIs making mistakes still, but they're never going to be worse than they are today. And if they get better, it's just really a fascinating time to be alive. So we'll see. I have been told that this company that is subsuming the entire IT staff from headquarters, I've been told that they're really big on AI. So, you know, maybe that's what it takes. And maybe that's what's going to be the wave of the future. I'm happy to be on this side of it, not still working for a living. It's going to be fascinating to watch, though. I'm really, really looking forward to how this is all going to work out. Because, man, yeah, we'll see. We'll see. So I'll keep you posted as to how everything is going. We'll go from there. I'm still splitting time with my writing and the costuming. I'm basically just puttering on the writing in the mornings now, and then taking the rest of the time that I have free to work on Mario. I have made some significant progress. I'm down to the point that I just need to skin Mario's torso, which is basically just a big sphere because Mario is plump. I'm just having to skin his torso. And once I get all the details worked out on that, then there's just a bunch of grungy little stuff. I have to fit his eyes with mesh and have to get the shoes working, which is no big deal, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm well within striking range now because I do have a week left and it all seems doable. So we'll see. We'll see. I've got some fitting yet I have to do because I built the sphere that's his body and the mask, the whole head assembly, separately. And now I have a general idea of how they fit together, but I've got to put them on both at the same time and measure and get everything lined up as before I can really finish skinning his body. So we'll see. Let's see. I'm looking for some place to turn here and head back the other direction. We'll go up here. So the writing's going fine. The costuming is going fine. I had some notes picked out for today, and I've been kind of pondering whether I wanted to do them this week or wanted to do them next week. But, you know, now that I'm in the middle of this, I think we'll just do them this week. You know, the issue for me is that I've been talking about some of these issues a lot. And even I'm getting bored with it. Even though there is much to learn and much to say about these issues. And some pretty incredible notes to take and make on them. So maybe we'll go one more, because there's some stuff that I hadn't even heard about. Because as we go through the history, as we are told the history of things, we're often told that history by those who wish the current state to remain the current state, and so they have a tendency to skew the history towards the current state to preserve it, as opposed to admitting to the long history of of what has gone before. And I guess I just never imagined that there would be the kind of extended history that there has been with regards to something like vaccine hesitancy. But there was an article that was written by Jeffrey A. Tucker, who is an intellectual and has started something called Brownstone, I think it's called Brownstone Academy, which apparently is a gathering place for intellectuals where people can speak their minds freely, they can address issues and have other people offer their opinions about those issues. And it doesn't matter what side of the political spectrum you're on, you have a right to speak, and then you have a right to endure any criticisms that others might bring. But it's all done in a collegiate spirit and in the interest of getting to the best answers, which is not something that has been generally seen in any kind of academic setting for some time. So that's very interesting. Supposedly they also have, they're also starting, what did they call them? Not sessions, but they starting these meals, you know, where you can go and have a meal and discuss heavy topics. And it sounds very interesting. But Jeffrey Tucker, this particular podcast notes, these came out of an article that was referred to by Jeffrey Tucker in his recent conversation with Brent Weinstein. And as he was talking about this article, I had thought, wow, that sounds like an interesting topic for a podcast. But it was on vaccine hesitancy, and so the more I've thought about it, the more I was like, I've talked about this stuff a lot, but, you know, like I said, there is some interesting stuff in here. And I am parked, and I've got, 20 minutes or so before I pick up Aiden. I won't go the whole 20 minutes on this, but it's really interesting. So the name of the article was, that Jeffrey Tucker had done research on, was How Long Has Industry Captured Vaccine Regulations? And he starts out by saying, among the many incredible revelations over the past 5 years is the extent of the power of pharmaceutical companies. Through advertising, they have been able to shape media content. That, in turn, has affected digital content companies, which responded from 2020 onward by taking down posts that questioned the safety and efficacy of the COVID vaccines. They have captured universities and medical journals with donations and forms of financial other forms of financial control. Finally, they are far more decisive in driving the agenda of governments than we ever knew. Just for example, we found out that in 2023, that the NIH shared thousands of patents with pharma with a market value approaching $1 to $2 billion. And this was all made possible by the Bayh-Dole Act of 1980, which was pushed as a form of privatization, but ended up only entrenching the world's corporatist corruptions. So they actually talked about this on the podcast, and he said in one of their brownstone meetings, they had one of the congressional representatives there who voted in favor of this bill and was shocked to find out how far it had gone in the time since they voted on it, because it was a fairly innocent thing. Oh, well, it's very difficult for these companies, you know, to keep going, and, you know, this is a way that we can privatize some of these things that really need to be done, because the NIH, well, they know what needs to be done and they've got this preliminary research, but it's really hard to get it out into the public. So if they just share their knowledge with the drug companies, then the drug companies can go ahead and share patents with them. And now we can get a lot of these drugs done that we'd been hoping to get done. And, you know, the government just can't do it. So that, of course, has turned into the NIH and other mechanisms figuring out how to get drug makers involved in as many drugs as possible, because all that money then is coming back into the NIH, and then that can get assigned out to people in the NIH and they can make a little extra money. And it honestly doesn't take too much of a leap to figure out where that would go if you've got the same organization or adjacent organizations approving drugs as are inventing the drugs. So, you know. And of course, Jeffrey Tucker in the article mentions the National Childhood Vaccination Injury Act of 1986, which again was done with the best of intentions, because the pharmaceutical companies went and said, look, these drugs are so dangerous that we're developing that there's bound to be harm to children, but there's so much more good that's going to come that if you don't indemnify us, we're just going to have to stop selling these drugs. And that's going to be that. So, you know, they pushed, got a bill pushed through that says you're not liable for the damages. Well, it really doesn't take very much to figure out what's going to happen then, because it's a lot easier to just shrug your shoulders and say, well, we're indemnified, you know. So, you know, he does note in the article that pharma today arguably competes with the military munitions industry in its holdover power. No other industry in human history has managed to close the economics of 194 countries to force most of the world's population to wait for its inoculation. Such power makes the East India Company, against which the American founders revolted, look like a corner grocery store by comparison. So, you know, he goes on and traces it back. And he says, legend has it that Edward Jenner invented and proved vaccination in 1796. Not a new method, but simply cross immunity. The famed discovery celebrated by Thomas Jefferson. In fact, the actual proof of cross immunity from cowpox dates back 22 years earlier with the work of a British farmer named Benjamin Jesty, who first proved what folklore had long speculated. Jesty languished in obscurity while Dr. Jenner became the physician to the king himself. And so the idea, I think where the idea got started, is somebody noticed that girls who milked cows didn't come down with like smallpox or something. And then after they thought about it for a while, they realized that, well, cows get cowpox, and maybe there's some kind of a transfer that maybe the girls are coming down with mild symptoms of cowpox, but in the process, their body is building immunity against smallpox, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the very first federal effort to push vaccination, however primitive or dangerous it was, the article says, was from President James Madison. The act, quote, the act to encourage vaccination of 1813 required that smallpox vaccines be given away for free and promptly delivered to anyone who requested them. James Smith, known as the Jenner of America, had actively lobbied Madison, promising to forward a supply of genuine vaccine matter to several surgeons now in the actual service of the United States so that it should be deemed expedient they might immediately secure the troops under their care from any dangers they might be liable to in case they were exposed to the contagion of smallpox. So this Smith was appointed as the vaccine agent for the country, and the pretext for such unusual action, the federal government was not in the business of pushing medical or consumer products at all, was the aftermath of the War of 1812. So, which gave rise to widespread disease and fears. So they said at first this vaccination was limited to wealthy elites. Only years later did it reach the general population. And as injury and death piled up amidst the cries of profiteering and corruption, Congress acted decisively in 1822 to repeal the act. So the turning point for that was the fact that James Smith had actually sent material containing live smallpox vaccination viruses instead of the cowpox vaccine to a physician in North Carolina. This caused a local smallpox outbreak, infecting 60 people and resulting in approximately 10 deaths. Now, just pause there. So because 60 people got infected and 10 died, that was sufficient in those days to damage public and congressional trust in the federal program's ability to safely handle and distribute vaccine matter. I consider that to be amazing. That all it took was 10 deaths. And people said, wait a minute, stop. We're not doing this. 10 people have died. So we're well past that now, because when you look at something like VAERS, as soon as they started giving the COVID vaccine, that thing takes off like a hockey puck. There was obviously problems, but we just kept giving it. So even so, when Civil War broke out in 1861, there was a push to get all the soldiers vaccinated to stop deadly smallpox outbreaks. And with that came a slew of injuries and deaths. Historian Terry Reimer writes, quote, unfavorable results from vaccination or spurious vaccinations were all too common. Even pure vaccine obtained from the official army dispensary sometimes caused complications. Sometimes faulty preservation of the crusts could have compromised their effectiveness. As in the case even with modern vaccines today, occasionally the vaccine did not take, failing to produce the major reaction at the vaccine site that was expected. In some other cases, the site of the vaccine became swollen and sore, and abnormal pustules developed, leaving surgeons to question whether those vaccines had been effective. So They go on to say complications from using a scab from a recently vaccinated adult were even more deleterious. Since many vaccines took place in hospital, crusts from men who were sick with other conditions were occasionally used unintentionally, spreading disease rather than preventing it. So what they're doing is they've got these scabs from an infection, and they're taking these scabs of people and putting them on someone else, thinking that, oh, well, their body won't get a full dose of this, and now they'll develop an immunity. But the problem is those people they were taking the scabs from had other illnesses as well. And so when they were transferring them, there were problems. So perhaps the worst and unfortunately common form of spurious vaccination was the use of scabs that were syphilitic in nature. So if you had patients who had syphilis and you harvest scabs from those people, then basically you are just spreading syphilis around your hospital. Yeah, so that's kind of a bad day. And in fact, they had said there were two brigades were affected by a vaccination infection that was thought to be syphilitic in nature, and the men were so sick that the brigades were unfit for military service. And the epidemic was traced to a single soldier who had obtained vaccination material from a woman who had likely had syphilis. So, you know, at that point, you are a century and a half deep into the vaccine experience with mixed results owing to unsafe methods and spurious products. But there was no giving up. To the contrary, medical journals of the 19th century were filled with optimism about the capacity of medical science to cure all diseases and even grant eternal life, provided the mixtures and administration were improved. And that was interesting to me, that for a time it was really thought that there would, quote, be no apparent inherent reason why man should die, except our ignorance of the conditions governing the reaction going on in his protoplasm, they said. And they could fix those problems just with the artificial synthesis of living matter. So one of the things that was driving forward the early vaccination movements was not only to keep people from dying from specific diseases, but keeping people from dying at all. He goes on to say in the article that the turning point came in 1902 with the Biologics Control Act, the first true intervention by the federal government during the Progressive Era that set the stage for the regulation of all food and medicine. In fact, this act came 4 years before Upton Sinclair's novel, The Jungle, that inspired the passage of the Federal Meat Inspection Act. Okay, so, you know, you've got the FDA coming on, blah, 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 et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, as it goes on, you know, you've got more and more energy being put against this. But what's interesting is that in the middle of all this, in 1901, there was a slew of well-publicized deaths from vaccines. In Camdenton, New Jersey, there were 80 infections and 11 deaths from tetanus that were traced to a single poison vaccine. In addition, there were other incidents in Philadelphia, Atlantic City, Cleveland, and Bristol, Pennsylvania. At that point, the reputation of the industry was in free fall. Something had to be done to bolster market share. The industry ran to Washington, pulled out all the stops to get regulated, posing as the business that hated regulation but was willing to acquiesce. So then the pharmaceutical company comes in and says, oh, we need regulations. You know, we're willing to acquiesce to regulations. So then you've got people saying that the histories written about this 1902 act that was enacted after that generally describe it as simply a congressional response to St. Louis and Camdenton incidents, as if the law was the outcome of some routine congressional process. In fact, the 1902 act was an initiative of several large biologics manufacturers, and it was enacted with the cooperation of the Public Health Service. They sought the passage because they feared the contamination incidents would cause additional state and local health departments to make their own vaccines and antitoxins, wiping out the commercial biologics business. So some medical publications also called for the government inspection and licensing of biologics. The Journal of the American Medical Association editorialized that, if necessary, legislation should be had forbidding the sale or use of any antitoxin not tested and certified by some competent authority. So you've got all of this maneuvering back behind the scenes from the pharmaceutical companies, that when something goes wrong, then they work in the background to change public opinion, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So one of the major companies that was shoving things around in the background was called Parke Davis. This is the company that sought to reduce competition by establishing strict governmental standards that small producers would have found difficulty meeting. Shortly after the law was enacted, Parke Davis wrote to the Public Health Service with suggestions for regulations stating, "Are you perhaps aware the regulations cannot be too stringent for us?" Oh. Yeah. So he's got a comment in here by one of the commentators of the Times that said, "It is impossible to disentangle the desire for strict regulations to boost public confidence from biologic from the desire of such regulations to eliminate competitors. But it is noteworthy that several biologics producers went out of business because they were unable to pass these inspections." And I mean, it just goes on and on and on and on. As for Parke Davis, it was acquired in 1970 by Warner Lambert. In 2000, Pfizer acquired Warner Lambert in a $90 billion merger, the largest pharmaceutical acquisitions in history at the time. This brought Parke Davis under Pfizer's umbrella, where the company remains today. Okay, So then in 1905, the author of this article goes on to say, the industry received the greatest possible gift from the Supreme Court. In Jacobson versus Massachusetts, the court blessed forced vaccination on the grounds that public health must always trump the freedom of consciousness. And he goes on to say, here we are 123 years later, and the implications of the 1902 Act are still being felt, complete with the overwhelming influence of industry cartels that drive federal regulatory efforts. Yeah. So, yeah. And he says that while the events of 2023 have again raised profound questions about the power of the industry, along with the triggery concerns about injury and death from shot mandates, he goes on to say, now that people are trying to talk about this, the industry tried mightily to stop this flow of information using the brutal tools of censorship that labeled all vaccine doubt as disinformation, misinformation, and malinformation. And they succeeded for a while. But of course, more and more information is coming out. And in addition, the public lives with the deep wounds and lasting trauma of the COVID period, knowing full well of the industrial interests that push for the shocking policies that throttled human rights and wrecked social functioning, all in the interest of pushing an inoculation that not only failed, but has caused suffering without precedent. At long last, after such a long struggle for the freedom to choose, it appears that finally some degree of accountability is coming for an industry that has relied on the government backing since its inception. You know, I know, see, that's the how he finishes up the article, but I don't know that that's true. I haven't seen anybody being held accountable. I mean, honestly, I haven't. And it seems like all this stuff is just kind of getting swept under the rug, and it's like, yeah, whatever, because I don't know who's in charge of the pharmaceutical industry, but there's a bunch of smart people over there. And they figure out a way to wiggle out of it. They figure out a way to make things sound good, like, oh, children have to be protected. You know, so you need to sign this thing to give us indemnity. I mean, these guys have been two or three steps ahead all the way for hundreds of years they've been working. So that's what was really interesting to me about this, that the companies who have engaged in this type of biologics, for some reason, have been able to just push stuff through the government and convince people to see their way of it over and over again. And I'm guessing they have enough power now that they're just going to keep doing it. So it's really fascinating. It is just so fascinating. So we'll see. We'll see if we ever have one of these incidents again. And we'll just see if how soon they start talking about mandates and people got to stick things in their arms and people got to do this and do that. I can tell you for sure that I will not be receiving such a vaccine. It's not going to happen. Anyways, got a weekend coming up. Got a lot of fun stuff planned for the weekend. Be safe. Get outside. We have gorgeous weather here today. And God is good to us. Have a great weekend, everyone.